Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Australia's sometimes been described as the 51st state of America. We don't have close military ties. We are almost a chicken jowl. Since the 50s, Australians have been fed a steady diet of American TV, film and fashion, mostly via television. But in this new digital world, traditional television audiences are splintering. Our consumption of media is moving online. We're entering a future where we have a lot more choice than ever before when it comes to cultural influences we're exposed to. So what is the future of culture in a digital world here in Australia? Will the world move towards some kind of super global culture, or will it become more diverse? Whose cultural values will influence our future? Pretty big questions, and they're ones we're going to put to business futurist Morris Maslowski, who joins us in studio tonight. Morris, good evening.
Hello, Tony.
The term culture encompasses a lot. What are we talking about here when we talk culture?
So I use a pretty simple definition for it. Culture to me is really a collective set of behaviours, and it's a set of behaviours that a group of humans take together. It's kind of shaped by their structures, by their rituals, by their symbols, by their artifacts, and importantly, it guides their values. So it seems to be the glue that sticks together a group of people and makes them somewhat similar.
How much has the country been geographically influenced through the years?
Well, culture has always been geographically influenced because culture, on the biggest sense of it, was always about a physical place. Remembering back that only 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't travel as we do now digitally. We don't come in and out of countries every second of the day as we do when we search online. So we took our cue from the physical people around us, the people we lived with and around, mostly 20, 25 kilometres from our feet. So the country dictated the way that the people behaved and what they thought was important. And we've seen that right throughout history. We saw the Roman Empire going back 100 AD and their influence across the world when they sent their ships out to conquer other places, how their thinking, their money, their cultural habits, their sports took over the lands that they conquered. The Chinese did it in 1200 AD, a similar thing. As they took on the world, they spread their culture to the world and it became dominant to the people that they took over. The Mongols did it. The British Empire did it. And lastly, the Americans, who since 1950s have sent their culture, their thoughts and what they think is important to the rest of the world. And for many people, we've accepted that as being a dominant way of behaving and thinking.
Yeah. I suppose they were left on top as well because of the collapse of the old Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. They've almost become the world policemen and also, I guess, the holders of the flame as far as culture is concerned.
And we've allowed them to do that. We've given them permission and we've said to them, overtly or covertly, look, we uphold what you think. We think the values you have are worth fighting for, and collectively we'll do what we can to help you out. And that's pretty much been America's role since post-World War II.
I suppose you could say that they were the flow-on from the British. Obviously the very similar British connection to ourselves, really.
Yeah, they absolutely were. They were the natural successors to the British Empire, and we saw the British Empire's influence across India, across America, across Australia, across Fiji, across all the lands they touched. And really it comes back to this notion of culture is something that we come in and out of. We have this base culture, which is represented by the physical place that we live, or that was true up until about 20 years ago. And then you and I have a myriad, perhaps thousands of cultures that we come in and out of every day, depending which group of people we're talking with, what we're doing at the time. If we're playing tennis, we might have a slightly different culture to our coffee group, to our parents, to our children. And that's something that humans have done particularly well. But now we have this entire new digital world on top of it that really is beginning to stretch and fray what it means to have a culture.
Mm. It is an area that's of great interest to me. I remember, you know, growing up in Australia in the 50s and 60s, it was very monocultural. We had, you know, a spaghetti bar open up around the corner and we were absolutely thrilled, and we had a coffee shop open for the first time. It was almost a replica of Britain for a long period of time, Australia.
Yeah, it absolutely was, and you're right. I mean, that Chinese restaurant that came out in the 50s and 60s, the fish and chip shop, all of those things were kind of physical manifestations of culture slightly changing and including other people that weren't quite like the ones we'd seen before. And we have evolved. We are known around the world, and certainly by ourselves, we think we are anyway, a multicultural society, being a culture that accepts other people's values and tries to bring them in line with our own and tries to use some of those things that we think are better or worth having into our own culture.
We're looking at 2050 today, and they keep saying that this is going to be the Asian century. Is that going to be reflected by halfway through?
I think somewhat it is, but again, that goes back to a geographical notion, and that's what culture's always been. But the argument now, for me anyway, is that we are influenced, and that's what culture really is. It's our influences. It's what we see. It's our steady diet of things that we read, that we engage with, and that we begin to think are important. And a lot of that is coming from our online activities. And we don't really know often where those thoughts are starting from. They're just in the digital space. The article we're reading could be from anywhere. It could be written by anybody. And we are really, in many ways, digital immigrants every moment of the day as we walk into the internet. And the argument is that we are absorbing all of these things, and we're beginning to change away from a geographical base to a digital base of accepting all kinds of things. And yes, the Asian influence will grow over the next 20, 30, 40 years, especially in our region, and again evolve what it means to be, what it means to have a culture.
We also saw in, I think, probably the 1970s, a major change happen, and that was, I suppose, the arrival of the jumbo jet. With that, all of a sudden, it became possible to travel to the other side of the world for not a lot of money. So we were able to spread our wings fairly effectively. But the digital age, I think, is taking it to another level, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, the 10-pound POM was a great example of that. We had lots more English people coming over after World War II. We had many Europeans coming over. And you're right, with the jet age, with the ability of people to travel, they certainly are travelling into Australia. Some of them are deciding to live here, and others are going back to their country. But again, that's a small group of people that are coming to a geography. And with this, we have the whole world available to us. For me, one of the trigger points this year was Netflix's announcement that they were going to be able to promote their products, being their shows, into 170 countries. And one of the conversations they had was really the reversal of that, that they would now be able to show content from 170 nations to the rest of the world. We've got, on the planet, 180 countries, roughly. We've got 4,200 religions on the planet. We have 6,500 languages. And up until now, each of those has been discrete. They've been in their particular physical land that they survived or lived in. And we're now beginning, regardless of where we physically are, to digitally be connected, to digitally hear, and I'd argue digitally be influenced by these thousands of religions, thousands of languages, and many, many cultural country-specific habits.
Yeah. I think what happened, Morris, too, we didn't really know what a lot of people looked like or sounded like or spoke like. For example, when Ronald Reagan in the 80s described the Soviets as the evil empire, I guess we all shuddered a little, wondering exactly what they held. But all of a sudden, we discovered they're Russians.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen that throughout time. We've seen it in our science fiction, our books. We see some leaders on the planet doing the similar thing. They're isolating their people and, again, turning them against other people, not really because they've seen or experienced them, but because they're being told these people have attributes. And that tends to be what happens with humans, where we don't know somebody, where we haven't actually seen them or experienced who they are or understood what it is that they're thinking and why they're thinking something, we often demonize them. And perhaps this is one way that the digital world, I think, will help to evolve humanity, as we have ready access to people, who they are, what they stand for, why they believe in things, why they eat things, just generally who they are as humans. Perhaps we'll stop demonising or be less critical about people.
What do you expect to happen to language? You know, you were just saying 6,500 languages across the world. Is English the universal language?
It seems to be for us. In fact, the largest group of people on the planet speak Mandarin, and that's going to grow over the time as well. We have, of course, that particular cultural influence, and in China, it replicates most of the sites we have, the eBays of the world, the Facebooks, the Twitters. They have their own representation of those, and they don't necessarily come into our world, so we're not as influenced by them yet. But I think that what we're going to see is a language like English, which is at this stage a dominant language, continue to be the language that most people speak on the internet. What's interesting out of the 6,500 languages is that 90% of them are spoken by fewer than 1,000 people. And my concern with that is that I think over the next 20, 30, 40 years, unless we begin to record these languages, that they will be forgotten.
I've mentioned a few times a language that I've heard spoken in Malacca, in southern Malaysia. And it's only about 3,000 or 4,000 people, I think, that speak it. And it is one of those situations where it has become so disconnected from the mother tongue. It was obviously Portuguese, one strongly suspects, that the Portuguese find it almost impossible to understand.
And that's what we're seeing. I mean, indigenous languages have been lost or are being lost at the moment. I've seen some really good work being done around recording these languages from the few survivors of people that understand them and making sure that they're available for generations moving on. It's also interesting how the English language is evolving in this digital multiculturalism. There are words now that, I especially, but perhaps you as well, have difficulty with, and those are the words that are used in Twitter or in Facebook, those words that are collapsed into where they might have been five syllables, now collapsed down to two or three, and we've kind of got a guess at them. But that's still language evolving.
I suppose even with spelling, that has changed considerably, simply because obviously the American culture dominating, the American spelling seems to be a lot more generalised today.
It does, and more accepted. And in Australia, we still rally against it. It is still grammatically correct to spell in the Australian way of O-U instead of the O. So we're seeing that there is some pushback on it. But across the years, I think that we're going to lose that fight and we will see the American language take over. But I think that what we're seeing is a fracturing of language anyway across all of these spaces, that what we're seeing is a change which I think is more relevant to the situation. So there's a language that we would use on air tonight together. There might be a slightly different sort of language that we might use in a coffee shop again. And our group of mates talking on the Twitter or the Facebook or something else, again, would have different language. And that's one of the beauties of where we're headed into tomorrow's space. It is our ability to understand the situation and speak and write accordingly.
Yeah. What about technology? Do you think we are going to reach a space very soon where, for example, if you are in Brazil and want to talk to a local in the Amazon jungle, you just use a technical device which translates what you were saying into Portuguese?
Absolutely. So what we have at the moment is Google, who made an announcement the last couple of weeks that their software will automatically translate in and out of 100 languages. And you can hook up your Google search and other Google products to do that automatically. Facebook offers some of those possibilities as well. What you get there, though, is often a word-for-word translation. You don't get the nuances. And we all know that there are peculiarities in language that just don't translate word-for-word. So I'm not quite convinced that we're there. I think we're still going to need some translators and some human wisdom around it. But we are increasingly getting to the space where it's absolutely possible for us to speak to and make contact with. And one of the things I love about this new space is that a 15-year-old in their tracky dacks sitting in their bedroom can now make contact with the CEO of the largest firm on the planet and do that within a couple of minutes by using one of these digital spaces. And even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that would have been an impossible thought. It's now an everyday occurrence.
Pretty funny. Some Asian friends of ours quite often reverse words. For example, instead of saying a global cultural influence, I'll say a cultural global. And instead of United Nations, say Nations United. Those words are, you know, certainly understandable. It's just that they're in a slightly different order than we're used to. Is this part of the future as well?
Look, I think it is, but what's happening there is a literal translation inside their head. What they're doing is taking their native language and the way that the way the phrases are made and the syntax of it, and then translating it into English. What you tend to find is that the more that people use a language, the more accustomed they become to phrasing it in a more appropriate way. But we're certainly going to not be as frightened of language because we will see it melt away. The Tower of Babel is a great example of this. I think that we'll see language slowly melt away, and online anyway, with these tools that we have, and just with the readiness to make contact with people, that we will be more able to speak with people than we ever have before.
I think a lot of boomers, when they were at school, probably did French or German as part of the high school education. They're almost becoming a little redundant these days.
Well, Madame Collet, who tried to teach me French for 3 years, would have argued that it was redundant.
And still
in my
curses
days too.
You, Morris, too. Well, I mean,
absolutely still curses me. So I made a valiant attempt, but really got no further than being able to say bonjour in three years of trying. So I'm not sure how much has changed. And again, technology will take care of some of that.
So where do we think the programming of the future will come from? We've seen, obviously, now the United States of Europe develop. We have now seen a very strong United States. We are seeing an independent Asia come through. Who's going to dominate?
I'm not sure any of them are going to dominate in the way that we're used to in the past. I'm convinced that what we have at the moment are 3.5 billion people on the internet. What we're going to have by the year 2020 is about 5 billion people. So we've got pretty much at that stage 60-65% of the world on the internet, and that's going to change who is dominant. We will have some players with louder voices, but as we've seen already since this new space has evolved, we're not hearing as much from governments, we're not hearing as much from traditional players in the space. We're hearing more from individuals and people that are able to either hijack the space, and ISIS is an example of that, or other people who are able to use it for a more benign purpose. So I think our culture is actually going to come from a multiplicity of places, some of it dominated by traditional geography, traditional governments, traditional big organisations. But I think we're going to be far more agnostic as well, where we'll take our influences from the myriad of people we come in contact with.
One of the great examples of that is news coverage. You know, when we were growing up, it used to be invariably reports from the United States that were repackaged for the Australian news bulletins, or perhaps British reports that had been rebooted. These days, we're even seeing Arabic services like Al Jazeera dominating.
We are, and we're also seeing the first-hand reporter, which is something that's very new, somebody in the field who literally has no more than their mobile phone with them, and they're able to show movie and have voice and do that on the spot. It's quite common now, and has been for the last 5 or 6 years, to take our first stories from Twitter. The Queen uses it, the Pope uses it, they all use it often as their first point of contact to the rest of the world. So all these spaces are really opening up a new horizon of information. What's fascinating for me in this space is that we seem to have this kid in a candy store where we can make so many choices from so many different people that we might want to hear from. But for most of us, we still isolate ourselves back to only a few sources. And we, in fact, look for people that are similar. And that's a human trait, similar to us, with similar opinions. And we then become more contactable and more attached to them than we ever have before.
If you'd like to SMS, you can, 0467 922 702, 0467 922 702. Morris, how will schools teach our kids to be good local and good global citizens. You know, I think when we were growing up, certainly the boomers, we felt a womb-to-tomb job was essential. These days, you know, you get a bit of experience here, a bit of experience there, and then you're off overseas.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the way it is. I mean, it's kind of like the gap year that we used to have back in the old days when we went to England for a year to experience the rest of the world. Our kids can now do that online and in all sorts of ways, but they still like to travel over. The reality for our children today, the ABS tells us, is that they're going to have 6 careers and 14 jobs. We've talked before about my notion that we will live, or they will live to 120 and most probably work until they're 90. It's impossible to teach them for that lifespan the skills that they need today. We honestly don't know what they are. 60% of the tasks they're going to do in the next 10 years haven't been created in industries that don't yet exist. Mm-hmm. So we have to be more creative in the way we teach them. And it's not teaching them in the way that I was taught, which was wonderful for its period, and that was with finite skills. It was kind of obvious what you wanted to do. You made the choice. You were filled up to the brim with all the skills and talents that you needed, and that was likely to see you through for your whole career. It doesn't work anymore. Our kids really need a very, very different education system.
It's awkward, isn't it? Because I think when we were growing up, it was essentially six radio networks, probably 4 TV stations, and that was all we knew. These days, you can tap into the other side of the world in the blink of an eye. I remember working in television in the early 70s and, you know, seeing, you know, newsreel footage almost on your TV screens. It was one of those scenarios where, you know, this was a bit of footage from a cyclone that hit 7 days ago. Now you're there and you're reporting it as it's happening.
And if it hasn't been done in the last second, you think it's old. You keep pressing the refresh button until you get something. It's quite extraordinary. I still talk about the times when you had to book a phone call for Christmas.
and then not get through as well, which was
absolutely
a lot of fun.
And that was something that Telstra or Telecom or whatever it was, PNG, used to talk about with some fanfare at the beginning of December in the way that they had resolved technology so that there wouldn't be a 5-day wait anymore. It was only down to 4 days.
And I remember going to Telecom at one point and wanting a phone put on, and they said, oh, that'll be about 19 weeks.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
and this still brings us back to culture. I mean, this is the conversation of culture, that was the way we saw the world. It was insular. Going outside of where we were, even by telephone, was so extraordinary. Watching vision was extraordinary. It wasn't part of our everyday lives. It was kind of science fiction-y. Today, we don't see that. We see it as science fact. We know that we can jump on Skype and talk to people that are literally thousands and thousands of kilometres away. We know that we can work digitally around the world. We can make contact and find out about anything we want. It's all so immediate. And it seems like an obvious conversation, but it's only been that way for the last 10 years for most people. But yet we've taken it for granted already, and we've only just begun the journey.
How much do you think the digital world will change our experience of being human by 2050?
I think it's going to extraordinarily change. We really have only just begun this journey. We at the moment, I think, are the equivalent of DOS days. We're in the equivalent of having to type things on a computer, know what we want to find, which is all great stuff. We've never had it before and we're excited about it. But we're moving very much into the experiential world, where with artificial intelligence, the ability for technology to understand what we want and to produce and provide it for us ahead of time and have it ready for us, with virtual reality and augmented reality, where we can put on headsets or see in front of us additional information, digital information, as well as the physical world that we see, all of these things are going to change our experience and the way we interact with the world. And in 10 years from now, the same way that social media has reshaped who we are and what we are, these things will reshape again what it means to be human.
It's really strange. There are twists around every corner. You know, virtual reality has got a lot of press over the last 6 to 8 months. It seems to be the hot issue of 2016. Somebody was saying that a lot of people in the United States are working on virtual reality assisting people with depression. This is, you know, enacting out particular scenarios that help lift your spirit.
Yeah, now virtual reality is the conversation of the moment, and that's because a lot of technology we've talked about literally for 30 years is finally coming to market in this quarter. For the first time, you can walk into a department store in the States and soon in Australia and buy headsets literally from $30 up to about $1,000 is where they mostly sit. So that's why people are getting excited by it. Personally, I love it. I've tried it and I can't wait for my next experiences of it. But it's going to take us a couple of years to bed this down. I think halfway through this year, towards the end of the year, people will wonder what all the fuss was about when they've tried it and there aren't too many things to do with it. But it will come back with a vengeance as soon as we start to build software and uses for it. And the medical one is a great one. I've seen it used by psychologists and psychiatrists to help people overcome phobias, where you can put people into a space that's obviously digital, that's not physical, and slowly immerse them into it. I've got some doctor mates who I've seen who are taking images of patients and their ailments, their brain issues there, and they are trialing in a virtual headset with a virtual scalpel the operations and making sure they're right before they physically get to a patient. There are all sorts of things that we're changing because of it. Education has a really good purpose in these headsets because you can digitally take somebody and immerse them in an environment. And we know people learn better when they feel that they're part of that environment. So it's far easier for Madame Collet to teach me French when I've got a headset on and I'm pretending to be in France than it was sitting in a classroom talking to my mate next to me.
Mm. Just on that surgery front, I was talking to somebody the other day who does cranial surgery on a regular basis and says it has become so much easier in the last 5 years simply because, you know, this great area that you think you'd know all about has become so much clearer.
It's extraordinary. I was lucky enough through Monash University in Melbourne to take a virtual reality tour inside the human brain and to have one of those wonderful surgeons as my guide. And we literally, with a headset, flew around the human brain and I was introduced to all sorts of things which absolutely make no sense to me. But it was extraordinary. And what he was taking me through was a teaching tool that is used to teach medical students about the brain. They have an insight into it that previous physicians had never had. And that doesn't make them better or worse. It just gives them new tools to use.
I suppose the world of robotics is part of this message as well because, you know, we have often seen them in movies and television programs and know that they're on the fringe of society at the moment, but perhaps I think in the next 10 to 20 years they're likely to become a lot more part of our life.
Well, they're knocking on the door. They're far closer than on the fringe. We already have lots of robots in our lives. Robots are really just machines. Even something as simple, I believe, as the dishwasher and the various appliances we have at home are really some kind of a robot. Personal robots, which is one of the other big trends this year, again, are going on sale in the high street stores in America and into Australia halfway through. There are some interesting robots around, and they're around the $1,000 to $2,500 mark. Now, let's not think this robot that looks like a human walking around with a butler's tray, which is what many people are waiting for. These are small little devices. Some of them have a cute face on them. Others are no more than a box, really a Siri on steroids. But their ability to interact with you, their ability to understand who you are and what you want, and to be almost like a digital concierge to sort through all the information online to make sense of it for you, to read your emails to your SMS, to make contact on your behalf. That's the first round of robots that we're seeing. And then there's all the other ones that are coming into our workforce. And again, that's going to change culture dramatically because we're going to have to learn to interact with these inanimate anthropomorphic beings. And we've not had to do that before. How are we going to go to work and shake hands with a robot?
I saw a digital golfer the other day who managed to get a hole in one, so anything is plausible.
Yeah. It's absolutely extraordinary, and these robots are on the horizon. I don't buy into this dystopian world, you know, this Arnold Schwarzenegger world where robots will take over. They're not that sophisticated. They're not that clever. They've certainly come a long way. Great people working on it, not to put them down in any way, but they don't yet have the nous, and I think it'll be some time till they do. But they will, and this is through humans, not through robots. Humans have decided for many reasons to allow technology to take over what was traditionally the work of humans. And we will see that increasingly be the norm over the next year, 2 years, but definitely 5 and 10.
Talking tonight about the future of culture in the digital age, and business futurist Morris Maslowski is my special guest.
Tony Delroy's Nightlife, the podcast.
Trish and Kiama would like to know what percentage of people speak English. Morris, can you help?
I don't know the official figure. Don't know. Perhaps one of our listeners could let us know.
Yeah, I would imagine that it would be substantial, but you know, when people say speak English, you know, some people have some language skills, but not complete power. So, yeah.
Well, we have Mandarins being the largest. That's 1.3 billion.
Yeah.
So it's got to be somewhere under there.
And a lot of them are learning English as well. So that's
they certainly
part
are.
Of the equation.
Well, again, that's part of the education system for them.
Yeah. Jill, you want to talk about virtual reality and the potential for things like dental treatment.
That's correct. I recently went to the dentist and it occurred to me that things might be a lot easier if we could sort of both go into the mouth and collaborate on where, you know, the way the teeth can be fixed, etc. What do you think about that? Is it Moshe?
It's Morris. And
Morris.
You're absolutely right, Jill. I mean, what we see there in dental treatment is all sorts of new possibilities. Virtual reality will allow your dentist to take that tour in the mouth with you and to understand what's happening, but also with other technologies that we're seeing with these wearable devices that are coming up, it'll also be able to monitor your mouth and your saliva and whatever else needs to be monitored and give that real-time information to dentists. And one of the most extraordinary things I've seen in the past couple of months around this dental is 3D printing of teeth. And that's a boon. I mean, that might take normally a couple of weeks or months to build a set of dentures, and this is literally built within a half an hour for your mouth specifically.
Yeah, Morris, I'm told that 3D printers are now selling for something like about $300.
Well, Aldi had them on special, I think, 2 weeks ago. So it really depends, and you're absolutely right. You can get them down to about $200, $300. They don't do very much. You're able to buy what are called filaments, which are mostly plastic at that bottom range, and you can make some small little objects or ornaments from them. The more sophisticated ones are roughly around the $5,000 to $10,000 mark going upwards, and it depends on what you want to make and what you want to make it of as to the pricing.
I suppose, Jill, wearable technology will also be a guide for us as well coming up, because not only can the mouth be monitored, but also just about all of your vitals as well. You know, if your blood pressure's up, they're going to be able to know at the local doctor's office.
Well, you're going to really do a lot of those things via apps. You know, there's a lot of monitoring apps I've noticed and monitoring software. I guess from my perspective, it's more about the structural and building of things that are normally very inaccessible.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to see that. I mean, there was a wonderful story moving out of dentistry just for a moment only a couple of weeks ago in the media where somebody's daughter had bought her father a wearable device, and through that wearable device, which he wore for her but really for no purpose for himself, he thought, they were able to work out that he was in the middle of having a heart attack and to get him some assistance very quickly. And those kinds of stories, I think, are going to be more ordinary, because what we've done for the first time ever is to open up a digital door inside of our bodies that monitors it 24/7. And I believe that within about 5 years or so, we'll all have about 9 devices on us at any given time.
All right, thank you very much.
That's not a problem. 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. John, you want to talk about the future of healthcare, what impact that is likely to have as we age.
Yeah, so I'm loving the show tonight. I'm actually studying futures right now. Huh? And a big question I have is about genomics and the future of healthcare and the delivery of it, diagnosis of it in the future.
Yeah, absolutely, John. So what we're talking about here is really, I think, a very, very different way. I believe that as of last year, we've moved into a phase which I refer to as wellness. Up until very recently, most people in Western society waited for their body to break down or for some evidence that something was wrong, and we then looked to a doctor or somebody else to help us work through what it might be. We took some test, or we took some historical information of what that thing might have been yesterday or the day before, and from that make diagnosis of what we think it might be. That whole world's changing now. We as individuals are now taking more control over our body. There is definitely this wellness phase of people now exercising and looking after themselves in a way that we've not done before or not done for many centuries. And also behind all of that, this digital ability to be able to look inside our body, and then genomics, which helps us to understand the body itself, the architecture of it, how it works and why it works, and then to supplement that. So all of these different understandings and approaches are now conspiring together to give us healthcare that we've not seen before.
Yeah, the human genome, I think, was mapped in, 2002, and I think everybody thought instantly we were going to get heaps of cures for things, but it's one of those things that's slightly more involved. John, do you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, so just recently I studied my degree in biomedical science, and I've gone on to study futures, and I often think about the future of healthcare, especially in Australia. And there are so many little problems, like access to clean water and just access to fruit and vegetables, that could solve so many problems. And so that's on one end of the scale. And then the other end of the scale is looking at genomics and extending life further. So I think in the future, we're going to have a balance between those two things. So it's really interesting, though, to talk about genetics and how it can play a big part of healthcare.
It's huge.
Yeah, it absolutely does, John. In Australia, over the last 150 years, we've doubled our average life expectancy, again, ABS stat, and we've done it without genomics, without the things we've spoken about tonight. It, I think, will be extraordinary when we start to apply the DNA, which you said we stopped, we mapped out 14 years ago, and it'll take us another few decades to really make sense and purpose out of. But when we start to get these technologies conspiring, we're going to have a very different perspective on the human body and how we extend it and how we look after it.
Yeah, that's super interesting, because it's got, economic factors play a part with the aging population and all that. It's a lot to think about.
Indeed, John. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. Russell, you want to talk about the driverless car issue, and you're expecting it to lead to a massive drop in car ownership over the years.
Yes, I can see that it's pretty imminent, and, once driverless cars exist, there's probably no reason to own your own car anymore, because you would simply call up and order a car, it would come and pick you up and drop you off where you want, and then you'd book another car to pick you up at another time and take you back. I think it'll have some other benefits too. I think it'll be the end of traffic jams.
Believe it or not, I think one of those Google cars crashed the other day. I think it's the first time it's ever happened. But, into everybody's life a little rain falls. But they're driving on many roads in the United States at the moment, and I think they're about to test quite a few in South Australia.
They are, and South Australia is the first place in Australia that's taken up the mantle. The Google car had a slight accident. It is the first time an accident's been reported. It was travelling at 2 miles per hour and hit a bus that was travelling at 15 miles per hour. And it's stated that it's because the car was trying to swerve around the bus, but the bus decided to swerve in a different direction.
Yeah, well, these wrinkles will happen, but I would imagine it's going to be a lot safer than having human drivers on the road.
So, Russell, you're absolutely right. I believe that by 2050, in fact, we will not be able to get a driver's license except under special circumstances. And that's something that as a society we need to grapple with. The driverless car, for me, is still most probably 10 years off. I think by 2025, we'll have 1 in 4 cars sold will be driverless. Driverless meaning that you can drive it if you wish, but should you want, you can engage an autopilot function on it and it will take off. And the work that we're doing, and I actually spoke this morning to a car manufacturer about this, and an insurance company last week as well, it's going to change the entire nature of insurance. We believe that there will most probably by 2030, hopefully, drop deaths on the road by about 70%. Accidents will be fewer. Car service will be fewer. All sorts of industries are going to change. And again, it is going to impact on culture, because our culture for the last 110 years or so has been built around transport. It's
What a state government's going to do without the driving fines. That's another issue
as
well.
That's a great question.
Russell, thanks for the call. Michael, you're asking, can we expect to see human intelligence merge with artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I saw Johnny Depp last night, Rebecca Hall in Transcendence. Have you guys seen it?
Yep.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and what did you think of the kind of the merging of human consciousness with
It's a really big debate. I mean, some people believe that we are fairly close to it. There's actually been some interesting studies that have come out in the last month where they claim that they have been able to begin to hook up people's brains and to upload and download. I've read through that, and I think that's very embryonic in those stages. What you're talking about is what the field of transhumanism, which is where we begin to see humans and machines as one and the same. And there's been everybody from science fiction to some of the greatest thinkers today work through that and see whether it's real. Some people fall out on the basis that it's 100% doable. I think we're still a long way off. We already have, as human beings, lots of machines inside of us. We just don't realise it. We've got pacemakers and we've got artificial hips. There are all kinds of bits and pieces. Now, my stretch on that is that we have already started down the road of implanting things into our body to make our body better than it was before. The notion of artificial intelligence is the ability to think beyond the human brain. We're going to be assisted to do that over the next while. We already can. Watson's is an IBM computer that's doing it for many industries. A lot of our software is actually artificially intelligent to a very basic degree. I think as humans, we're going to rely on artificial intelligence more than we ever have before. Our cars, the healthcare, everything we've talked about tonight is presupposing that will be around. But I'm hoping that human will still have wisdom.
Yeah.
And that's really the difference. For me, computers are really all about answering questions, and humans should be asking questions.
Doing the best we can, Michael. Thanks for sharing. Bill, you're wondering about the digital divide. How can we make sure people aren't left behind as the tech increases?
Exactly. I've been in the tech industry virtually all my life, so coming up to about 35 years now, and I've seen a lot of changes. And one of the big things, and we're talking about the NBN now, is that all these wearable devices and everything are great, but without fibre to homes and things like that, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about will just be a pipe dream because we won't be able to use it. The other thing I wanted to point on was nanotechnology, and that is that you talked about 3D making of teeth and all artificial hips, pacemakers, all that. My take on that is, and watching the industry, is that we'll start to move in this wellness thing where we'll have actual machines that are in the body that are monitoring different things, monitoring the stresses on joints and stuff like that, and also being able to back up the your immune system. So you might have, you know, particular nanites that go and help T cells kill off cancer cells, things like that. All that is now technically possible as we go down. On driverless cars, I don't think we'll see driverless cars for people being the first thing. What I think we'll see probably in the next 5 to 10 years is driverless trucks. And where that is what Volvo and Daimler are doing, where you have one or two drivers, and in that you'll have a dozen trucks or two dozen trucks will then converge and will make one big road train. But there'll be two drivers or whatever driving those, and the rest of them will be following. So I know I could talk also about some stuff that's happening with fighter jets, where you'll have one fighter jet with a pilot. When they get in, they'll deploy drones, and those drones will then act as extra backup for those pilots.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Thanks, Bill. I've got to leave it there, unfortunately. A lot of people saying also, Morris, that, planes today, your modern passenger plane. You know, quite often the pilot will take off and land, and the plane will guide you the rest of the way. So,
and in fact, it is the way that's done. And we would not get into a plane where a pilot hasn't trained inside virtual reality, and that's been the reality for the last 20 years as well. So all of these worlds are really coming out of the extraordinary and moving into the ordinary.
Absolutely.
And it's going to impact on what it means to be human.
Thank you so much for being there tonight. Really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Catch you again real soon. Business futurist Maurice Maslowski joining us tonight.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.